War Heidi asked, in aid of the present grand jury investigation. Will you agree to submit to a polygraph examination? Let me talk about that with my attorney. And another thing, while we are discussing examinations, I understand at the time that your psychiatrist examined you in 1970 and the Army doctors examined you, there was some consideration given to asking you to take sodium amytal, truth serum, and submit to an examination under the influence of this truth serum. So I'm going to ask you to consider and discuss with your attorney cooperating with the grand jury to the extent of taking both the polygraph and the sodium amytal examinations. Let me make a comment about the sodium amytal interview, McDonald said. This was discussed with my psychiatrist, and it was his recommendation that unless there was an overriding need for sodium amytal, unless there were facts, and I repeat the word facts, that an amytal interview recreates. McDonald paused. May I assist you, War Heidi said, by saying that it causes you to relive the experience concerning which you are being examined, and that would constitute a painful ordeal for you. And in his opinion, at that time, you should be spared the experience? Right. Dr. McDonald, the event happened 4 years ago. I think you will agree it is high time that this matter was resolved. But resolved in what fashion, sir? To cover up the CID investigation again? I am not trying to cover up the CID investigation. The second Army investigation was finished a year and a half ago. This is unbelievable. We are going to go into that, War Heidi said. That is one of the reasons you are here. For 5 days in August, Jeffrey McDonald testified before the federal grand jury. Looming over him throughout was Victor War Heidi, his voice, even at normal pitch, sounding in the confines of a courtroom like the blast of an ocean liner's horn. It was War Heidi's objective, at the start of the inquiry, to get McDonald on record in as much detail as possible. He then planned to bring forward witnesses who would contradict the testimony that McDonald had given. The final step would be to recall McDonald to the stand and to confront him with each and every contradiction. War Heidi paced himself, working slowly through the hot August days, aware that at any time McDonald could invoke his constitutional rights against self-incrimination and refuse to answer any further questions. He did not want McDonald to consider him, just yet, merely an extension of Grebner, Shaw, and Ivory, Pruitt and Kearns. The longer he was able to project an air of impartiality, the more likely McDonald would be to keep talking, and in the end, War Heidi was convinced, it was McDonald's own words which would incriminate him. Have you always had a good family relationship with your father, your mother, your brother, and your sister? Yes. Have there been any problems? Sure. Have there been any family crises? Yes, there have been family crises. Have these family crises had any effect on you and your life? Yes, I lost my family at Fort Bragg. That affected my life. I am referring, War Heidi said placidly, to your family consisting of your father, your mother, your brother, and your sister. Sure. My father died at the age of 48 when I was in my sophomore year at medical school. That affected my mother and affected us. My brother used drugs, and that affected us. My sister is mildly anxious, a young married female, and has her crises and calls in the middle of the night, but nothing spectacular. War Heidi then asked McDonald to describe his trip north from Puerto Rico in the fall of 1969, at the time of his brother's hospitalization, only 3 months before the murders. I received notification of a need for emergency leave, McDonald said. I was just told that my brother was hospitalized. I subsequently found out that he was in a state hospital. He had a bad reaction to drugs and apparently beat up some policeman or was put in a straitjacket and was taken to the hospital with handcuffs on. I think he had a broken wrist or something, and then he dove through the window of the state hospital. I arrived there like a day and a half later. How long were you there? 2.5, 3 days, Did you visit with any friends while you were in Patchogue at that time? Not that I remember. You don't recall seeing any friends at all? Friends of my mother's probably would have stopped by the house, but I don't think that... Well, this is a name that has cropped up, and I am going to throw it out to you at this time. How about Penny Wells? No. Do you know who I mean? She is an old girlfriend of mine. And you didn't see her on that occasion? No, sir. Warheide paused to look through some papers. Then he resumed. Now, I know there has been some talk about this famous jump party down in Texas. I won't go into that at this time. Feel free, sir, MacDonald said sarcastically. No, I'll save that for a later point, Warheide said. But I just want to know whether there were any social activities during other Green Beret training missions that were comparable to the so-called jump party. No, sir. Warheide shuffled some more papers. Now, going back to the occasion when you took the emergency leave and traveled to Patchogue, did you at that time go to a certain bar which apparently your brother frequented? The Shortstop Bar. The Shortstop Bar. Where is that located? I don't remember. I have been into a lot of bars to bail my brother out. This was either in New York, in Greenwich Village. I think that's where it is, actually. So while you were there, you went down to New York, Greenwich Village, and you went to this bar. Right. What was the purpose of going to this bar? To find out who had been selling my brother drugs. What drugs was your brother using? He said he had been taking amphetamines, uppers. And then the night of this bad trip, he told me that someone had given him two capsules. Typical drug abuser comment. And I said, what were they? And he said he didn't know. He presumed they were mescaline or LSD. Actually, I presumed that because he was in this tremendous hallucinatory state. He was having wild hallucinations. But when I questioned him, it was apparent that he had been speeding, taking amphetamines, for a long time that I hadn't been aware of. And on reflection, some of his prior actions seemed a lot more in tune with his speeding. For instance, he used to drive from New York to Chicago nonstop, and I used to wonder how the hell anyone can do that. It's a long drive. And he used to stay up all the time. He used to party day and night. It never occurred to me that my brother would be taking amphetamines. All right. Now, you went to this bar? Yes. Well, describe to us the people you saw in the Shortstop Bar. They were just bums, a bunch of guys that don't work for a living. A lot of my brother's friends are that way. They're just bums. They sit and drink all night, and now I find out they were taking a lot of drugs. So I had an argument in the Shortstop Bar with a couple of guys who said they knew Jay. I had been told that the bartender was one of the guys supplying Jay with speed. So I guess I got a little pushy with them, and there was a little scuffle, and I hit the guy or something like that. There was a little pushing and shoving. I went up to him and I said, do you know Jay MacDonald? Yeah, I know Jay. I said, do you know he is in the state hospital? Words to that effect. And the guy said, well, no, I didn't know that. I said, yeah, he had a bad reaction to some pills someone gave him. And he said, oh, or something. And I said, yeah. And I probably told him he was an asshole. And I heard he had given him the pills. And he said he didn't. You know, who the hell did I think I was sitting in a public bar accusing him of that? So the words got a little heated, and I pushed him, and he pushed me, and I hit him. That questioning had been designed to make only one point, and it had succeeded. Jeffrey MacDonald was a man with a quick temper and no stranger to physical violence. Seeming to skip almost at random from subject to subject, none of them directly connected with the murders, Warheide kept MacDonald off balance. All right, sir, Warheide said, brandishing a newspaper clipping. I have here a Newsday article that was published October 20th, 1970. The headline says, Beret Freed in Family Deaths, and it says in part, MacDonald and his attorneys expect to conduct their own investigation. The Army has never followed up on some of the leads that we turned up, MacDonald said. I plan to do a lot of writing and investigating. We hope to get either the appropriate civilian agency or to get our own investigators so we can find the real killers. Did you, in fact, hire your own investigators? I never hired investigators, no. My lawyers cost me up to $30,000 at that point. My mother had to sell her home to pay for it. Plus, I was trying to rebuild a life, and it became a little bizarre, and no, I didn't. That's one of my great sins, apparently. Were you personally seeking out the perpetrators? Only in a very ineffectual manner. That's not being very definite. Be explicit. It was the same type of thing as, you know, when you went into bars, you talked to some people. I tried to track down Helena Stokely. It just isn't like Kojak. It doesn't work that way. But you were making an effort. Yes. On your own. Yes. But I'm talking about a, you know, it was very difficult at that time for me to walk into a bar in Fayetteville and play undercover agent. This thing had been on the front pages for 6 months. There were hundreds of reporters around. You know, they were all over the place at the time. Well, you had friends. Were they helping you? Not specifically, no. Were they helping you in a non-specific way? Yes. My lawyers still got leads. We still got phone calls. We still had things like that. Nothing great, no. Well, when you went into these bars around Fayetteville, were you alone or did you have someone with you? I believe usually I was alone. I probably had some army friends with me occasionally. Can you recall the names of any of these army friends? Not at this time, no. But you were looking for the people who might be the perpetrators you described. Right. What leads did you have? Look, Mr. Warheide, I can't come in here 4 years later and make it sound like I was some sort of avenging hero going through Fayetteville. That isn't what happened. You know, I went to bars. I questioned people. I asked some things. There were, you know, probably occasional little pushing matches. This isn't a big deal, this thing. What do you mean by pushing matches? Well, you know, I would get upset. You know, with some doper. And then what would happen? Usually nothing. When something did happen, what would happen? You mean you want me to recount every little fist fight? Is that what you want? If you can recall, yes. When you say, every little fist fight, how many were there? A couple. I mean, you know, I was a very visible person in the community at that time. I could walk into a bar and 50 people would stop and say, hey, that's Captain McDonald. You don't really get much information that way, unless someone wants to come to you and give you information. How does the situation develop that would result in a fist fight? I was sitting in a bar watching these kids buy little bags of pills right out in the open. They weren't even making any attempt to hide it. So I went over and sat down next to them. On reflection, it's really stupid. What happened then? I asked some questions about Helena Stokely. What happened then? People would say, it's none of your business. What happened then? I said, the hell it isn't my business, and I kicked his chair out. And there was a little scuffling? Yes, you leave before the MPs get there. This happened several times? Yes. Dr. McDonald, over what period of time did you engage in this investigative activity? I don't specifically remember. It was a period of, I guess, weeks to months. I don't specifically remember dates. Tell us when you initiated it and when you finally gave up on it. When I was released in custody in October until I got out of the army in December. After that, when you were living in New York, did you continue this activity? No, I did not. Subsequently, you moved to California. Did you continue the activity while you were there? No. In 1970, what was your personal relationship with your wife's stepfather, Alfred Kassab? It was very good. It's not so good now. Did he visit you from time to time? During the Article 32, but not after the Article 32 ended. Would you call him up and talk to him from time to time? Surely. Would he call you up and talk to you? Sure would. How frequently did you have these conversations? It seemed to me fairly frequently. And were you holding anything back from him?
No. Unfortunately, I made some things up.
What did you make up?
The extent of my own investigation.
All right. Tell the grand jury now what it was you made up.
Let me just say that I was trying to rebuild my life, and I was trying to get out of the army. We, my attorneys and my mother and myself, had begun to feel a little uneasy about Freddie, Mr. Kassab. He kind of took over the Article 32 hearing and a lot of the publicity surrounding it. He would hold news conferences up at LaGuardia Airport. He was writing letters and firing off telegrams to anyone that would listen.
Was this public officials?
Anyone who would listen. New York Times, Newsweek, magazines, radio, whoever he could talk to. And it was all in regards, I was the greatest guy that had ever lived. The army was absolutely hosing me, giving me a bad deal.
You didn't disagree with that, did you?
No. That, in fact, is what happened.
All right. Go ahead.
What I was leading up to was there was a sense of uneasiness. Freddie became a media freak, if you want me to be honest. And he started talking to me frequently and writing to me frequently, and it was always in reference to when we got our private investigation going. So then I said, I told him, I've been in some bars and you know, I've got some leads. Critical mistake in my life, telling him that I got some leads. That started it. And then it was incessant. What do you have? What have you found? And I'd lost my family, and I'd been through the hearing. I'd been wrongfully accused. Colonel Rock's statement at the end of a 5-month grand jury is, the charges are not true. He didn't say there was a lack of evidence. He said, the charges are not true, right? So I'm trying to get out of the army. I'm trying to figure out what's going to happen. And what do I do? Do I drift? Do I get into my residency? Do I spend the rest of my life prowling around looking for these people? And Freddie's hammering away, you know, about this investigation that we're going to. And then the authors started calling. When are we going to do a book on this? I can hook you up with a great publisher in New York. Lawyers from Long Island say, I have a good friend who is a writer. And it became this unbelievable public thing. Day and night phone calls. Not day and night literally, but frequent communications. So I sat down and talked to my lawyers and said, what do I do? And they said, do formal things. Do what you can. You're a physician. Go to Washington. So when I got out of the army, I went to Washington. Allard Lowenstein takes me around and introduced me to Sam Ervin. Can you imagine going to a cocktail party and talking about a homicide? Congressmen and lawyers advised me to go on TV talk shows. So I got on the TV talk show. I got sick to my stomach. After that, I said I wasn't going to do it anymore. They didn't have a right. Meanwhile, Freddie's driving me crazy. What have you found out? So I told him I'd found other people. So he asked me, to make a long story short, I implied that I killed the person. Absolute insanity. So his wife wants to know the details. Did they scream? Were they in agony?
What did you say?
I told him, I can't talk about it. So I left for California. What the hell was I supposed to do? But I still played along with this stupid game with Freddie. Freddie was an ex-intelligence officer in the Canadian Secret Service, or so he says, and he lives this day and night. He was in bars all through World War II, listening to secret conversations. He was in D-Day. He was on the battleship on it. He was everything at all times. So I played this game, and finally I gave it up and wrote a 10-page, 15-page letter, and I said, Freddie, I didn't do it. You didn't do this.
When did you write this letter?
I don't know. When I got to California. It was crazy.
How long did you play the game?
I don't know. Months, verbally, with him. It was always the one incident. It was always the same thing. Mildred wanted to hear the details. Did they scream? Were they in agony?
Mildred is Colette's mother?
So-called mother. She's been bizarre for a long time. So I made this tremendous mistake, this fantastic error. I tried to be a doctor. I tried to rebuild my life. and I moved away. That's my three crimes. I was keeping Freddie happy. He's crazy. This is absolute insanity. The man is a fanatic. He's an alcoholic fanatic. He has sat in that house and reread every single thing on this case for 4 years. That's a bizarre reaction to a tragedy. They haven't seen a friend. Friends come over to their house and try to take them out to dinner, and they slam the door in their face. The guy is a fanatic. What was your purpose, Warheide asked, in making the statement in a letter dated November 9, 1971, that's approximately a year later, that you had made 4 trips to North Carolina and Florida in the preceding 3 months, and that you were going to continue, and that you had broken a hand on the last trip? That was all part of this. I didn't have a broken hand. And it cost you $2,000? I was telling Freddie this great detective story, that I was doing all this work on the case because that's what he said he was doing. This is really just continuing that stupid game until I got up enough nerve finally to write him a letter and tell him the truth. Well, why all this explicit detail and color, like the broken hand? Were you implying you broke your hand slapping somebody? I suppose. You know, Mr. Warheide, my actions during that period of time. I apologize for them. Jesus, that doesn't mean I murdered my wife and kids. It was stupid. I've regretted it every single day since I wrote the letter to Freddie. I regretted it the day I started it. You talked in the letter about writing a book. At that time, were you involved in the writing of a book? It's never been written. There were a lot of interviews with authors and publishers. All these supposedly helpful friends of mine wanted me to write a book. I didn't want to write a book. So you keep putting them off, you know? Several people wrote beginning chapters, like, and tried to get front money. When it became apparent that I was going to have to sit down with a person for a period of months and go over the whole thing and sort of live with an author, I said, screw it. I'm not going to do it. I was trying to rebuild a life, and that's when I decided I've got to clear this up. So I wrote Freddie a letter, and I said, Freddie, what I told you in the past is not true. Warheide resumed his reading of the letter that MacDonald had written to Freddie Kassab. In the next paragraph, you say, the one difference between you and I is that I don't think that justice will bring back my family. I want revenge, preferably brutal revenge, and don't care about justice anymore. There is no justice, in case you haven't noticed. You act as though you were on a noble cause. I think the cause is ugly, brutal, but necessary. I will do it. I have done some. 1/4 or 1/5 of it. Now let's talk about that statement. What I was trying to tell Freddie is that he was on a soapbox all the time. He made it sound like this was some sort of glorious thing to do. He didn't understand. I never heard Freddie and Mildred say, I want Colette back. Never. They said they wanted to see someone hurt. What the hell does that do? Warheide then read from a copy of the letter that MacDonald had written to Mildred Kassab in March of 1973 after his angry telephone conversation with her husband. Is this the letter you were referring to when you said you'd sent it to Freddie? No. Warheide then read the paragraph in which MacDonald had admitted that some of the things he had told Kassab were not 100% true. Does that refresh your recollection as to whether or not this is the letter you are referring to? I thought I addressed it to Freddie and Mildred, and I believe Colette's Aunt Helen. I'm sure I addressed it to all three. Helen was living with them. Warheide then read the portion of the letter in which MacDonald had said he'd never had an affair, but that he had seen, dated, or slept with a very rare girl other than Colette. That's true. That's what I said to her. All right. Now, why were you saying that at this time in this letter? There had been a phone call from Freddie. He had called me up. He was drunk. It was the middle of the night, and he was ranting and raving that he had, maybe I'm exaggerating, okay, but I recollected him as saying that he had just come from Fort Bragg, and he had 15 affidavits that the MPs were supplying me with girls while I was locked up in my BOQ room. So I said, Freddy, that's the most ludicrous comment I've ever heard in my life. It's obscene, perverse, and it's incredible. He said, I don't know. He said he had sworn affidavits from 15 girls in Fayetteville that the MPs or the CID or someone was supplying me with females while I was locked in my BOQ. I said, Freddy, you're crazy. Did you have any females in your BOQ? After I was released from custody, sure. While you were in custody? While I was in custody? Females in my BOQ room? Yes. You mean other than friends and relatives? I mean, was there a girl who would come in and have sexual relationships with you during the period that you were in custody in your BOQ? No. Afterwards. During this time period, there was no such girl. There was a girl that used to... I used to sit outside with the MP guard and do some reading outside, and she was a clerk or something. And it started out, she walked by and she said, Hi, aren't you Captain McDonald? And I'm standing there with an MP guard behind me, so I said, Yes, I'm Captain McDonald. And it started out, then, like a month later, she'd come by and give me a tuna fish sandwich while I'm sitting out there. And after, I dated her after I, you know, I took her out on a double date with one of my escort officers, as a matter of fact. While you were in the BOQ under escort and guard? No. One of my escort officers who became sort of a friend after I was released from custody. She got another girl, and we went on a double date. We went to a movie and had dinner or something. What was his name? I don't know. What was the girl's name? I don't know. You don't remember her name? No. Does the name Bonnie Wood mean anything to you? Bonnie Wood, right. How frequently did you see her? I probably dated her several times after, before I left, before December. And you say Freddie purported to have affidavits from 15 girls? That's the sense of the conversation. 15. You say that is completely erroneous. Erroneous? There were not 15 girls? Will you say there were no girls? You mean in regard to having sexual relations in my BOQ room while I'm under guard with an MP outside the door? Yes. Yes, I would say that is erroneous. It was, in fact, not erroneous at all, as the CID's reinvestigation had revealed. As the week progressed, Warheide asked McDonald to try to recall the names of anyone to whom, in the first days following the murders, he might have given any account, however fragmentary, of the events of the early hours of February 17th. Eventually, McDonald mentioned his attorneys, saying one of his military lawyers gave me a yellow legal pad and told me to write down whatever I remembered whenever I remembered it. If you wake up in the middle of the night and remember something, write it down. And this went on. This went on for a month. Do you remember how long this statement was, or this compilation of data, this narrative? No. Have you seen that statement lately? I've seen it. I haven't read it. Can you tell me who has possession and control of it? My attorneys. Do you know of any reasons why that should not be shown or made available to the grand jury? Is there anything in there that you think might be harmful or detrimental to yourself? I doubt it. It would reflect severely upon the CID. I'm going to request that you make available to us these notes that you compiled. With all the irrelevancies and meaningless comments? Yes. As I understand it, that's an attorney-client product. It is privileged, Warheide agreed, and you are at liberty to refuse to make it available. The statement itself has nothing in it except what I recollect. I'm telling you that it is a privileged communication to your counsel. You can, if you wish, waive the privilege and make this information available to the grand jury. Mr. Warheide, are you setting me up as a fall guy? No, I'm not. I've got instructions from an attorney that gets $500 a day, and he says, you will not ever divulge attorney-client relationships, and here I am, divulging them. I have not asked you question one. I understand that. But the implication is, I'm asking you to consult with him and give us an answer as to whether or not you are willing to give us this statement either in whole or in part. If you wish to Xerox it and excise portions of it, you are free to do so. The problem is, the unfairness is, if I respond in a negative fashion through attorney, we'll be aware that you are doing it on the advice of counsel, and you might not necessarily agree with the answer, Warheide said. But it's your decision, not your counsel's decision. You can accept his advice or reject his advice. Warheide shuffled some more papers. Let me ask you this, he said. In April of 1970, when you went up to Philadelphia, you were examined by a forensic psychiatrist. I assume this examination extended over several days. It did. I don't know the dates. Now, besides seeing the psychiatrist, did you also see a psychologist who gave you certain tests? Yes, I did. But I think we're going to have to stop talking about attorney-client relationships. I'm not asking you what you said to him. Yes, you are. I'm not asking what the psychologist said to you. I'm just asking you, were you examined by a psychologist who gave you certain tests? Yes. Well, how long did you spend with the psychiatrist as opposed to the psychologist who gave you the tests? I don't remember. Was it part of one day or more than one day? Oh, it was more. How many days? I don't remember. I honestly don't remember. Could it have been more than 3 days? I would say that would be the upper limit. It was parts of 2 or 3 days. In fact, there had been only a single 3-hour interview. Now, between the interview by your own psychiatrist at the end of April and the Walter Reed examinations made in August, did you talk to anyone concerning the incident of February 16th and 17th? No one except reporters. Who were the reporters? I really don't remember, sir. There were hundreds of them. You know, they were all over the place, all the time. Did you give a full description of the matter to any of these reporters? I gave a long statement to one from Newsday. Was this with the knowledge of your attorneys? Certainly. Was it tape-recorded? I believe it was. Do you have any objection to our obtaining a copy of that tape? It's not my property. Would you personally have any objection? Only that my experience in the past with government prosecutors has not been very good, and you would have to view the tape with the understanding that that was a statement to a reporter. I understand that you are not under oath. It isn't even that. This was a duty for me to, you know, to try to sort of equalize all the bad things my family had to read up on Long Island and stuff, and the Kassabs at that time, my in-laws. Well, let me ask you this. Is there anything that you said in that statement that you feel at this time you would like to retract? I'd have to reread it. I'll get a copy. I'll give it to you. I'll afford you an opportunity to reread it tonight. I'd like to know, sir, in other words, what you're saying is that you're viewing the statement as a statement of fact from me. Otherwise, you wouldn't be interested in it. Well, it is a statement by you recounting your recollections of the events of February 16th and 17th. You know, this wasn't even really with thought. This is just talking to a reporter. It's not at all like, you know, I should turn this around and say, do you want me to bring the Provost Marshal's news clippings, what he said in the press? I'm not interested in what the Provost Marshal said. Well, you should be. I'm interested in what you, as a witness, having knowledge of certain facts, have to say. But the newspaper isn't facts, that's the thing. And this was an interview sort of arranged by high-powered defense attorneys who want a story told publicly. You know, if I'd had it my way, I wouldn't even have given the interview. That's not a legitimate thing to me. Well, it is a statement you made for the benefit of anybody who chose to read it, and the statement is attributed directly to you. Sir, I think there is a much fuller, better account of this in the Article 32 investigation, taken under oath. But this was prior to the Article 32. You were not under any pressure. You were not under any strain. I beg to differ with you. It was done voluntarily and purports to cover the same territory. To imply that I wasn't under pressure at that time in my life is outrageous. I was under tremendous. Did the reporter put you under pressure? The interview was, to me, yes. You were tense? Yes, I was tense, Mr. Warheide. You think you said anything you should not have said? I don't know. I'd have to reread it. I don't reread newspaper clippings. The next day, Warheide said, Dr. McDonald, I gave you a copy of the statement that was published in Newsday, and I asked you to review it and inform us today whether there was anything that you felt should be explained or modified. The answer is essentially what I said yesterday. This is not a statement under oath. It's a statement to a reporter for a news story, and I think it should be viewed as such. There are a lot of things in here that now, if I looked critically at it, aren't exactly correct, but I don't see what relevancy that has. I see questions which purport to be verbatim transcript of questions asked of you, and I see answers which I think purport to be verbatim transcript of responses that you gave. Sir, if you took what was quoted as verbatim in a newspaper, for instance, the Justice Department 6 months ago stating that this case would never be prosecuted, this is totally irrelevant. A news interview by a reporter. Did he ask you those questions, and did you give those answers? I don't remember each one specifically. I get a general feeling as I read it that it's essentially, generally, the interview I had. Would you say it has been doctored in any way? As I remember it, there are things that don't sound like me at all in here. I can't imagine me saying it. I don't know if it's been doctored or if I said it. Do you follow me? I don't remember stating some of the things he had me stating. I notice on page 7, Warheide said, and I don't want to get into the details of this right now, there is a, sir, may I say this? If this is going to be discussed, is the grand jury going to see it? I mean, they should see this if we're going to discuss it. At this point, Warheide continued, I just wanted to ask you, did you furnish this drawing that's set forth here? Warheide pointed to the diagram of the interior of 544 Castle Drive, on which McDonald had drawn stick figures to represent himself on the living room couch and the bodies of his wife and children in the locations in which he said he had found them. In his handwriting, there were identifications of the various rooms, such as Christie's, Kim's, L.R. No, sir, McDonald said. I believe this was a drawing furnished the news media by the provost marshal. So that doesn't represent your work product in any way. That's correct, McDonald said, despite the fact that the drawings had been made by his own hand. All right. I have here also a transcript of a CBS interview of Captain McDonald given on 11 December 1970. Can you tell us how this came about? No, I cannot. I don't remember which interview you're talking about. This is a CBS interview which was part of a Walter Cronkite news broadcast. The person who interviewed you is Bob Schieffer. Was that interview on Fort Bragg, sir? Well, Schieffer states at one point here, we talked with Captain McDonald in the office of New York Congressman Allard Lowenstein. I honestly don't remember that, being in an office in New York for an interview. There were hundreds of interviews like this during that time, sir. I honestly don't remember a CBS interview with Bob Schieffer. Do you recall who arranged this interview that took place in Mr. Lowenstein's office? Sir, I honestly don't remember an interview in an office. It may have occurred, but I really don't remember it. Most of these interviews were done on the phone. There were a lot of interviews at Fort Bragg where they brought TV crews to the BOQ. But on December 11, that wouldn't have been the case. You don't remember being in Congressman Allard Lowenstein's office, Bob Schieffer being there, and, I assume, cameramen and technicians? Sir, that was not an unusual occurrence at the time. Honestly, I mean, this was happening all the time. All right. I have here a somewhat more lengthy transcript captioned, Jeffrey McDonald's appearance on Dick Cavett Show, 15 December 1970. Do you remember that occasion, sir?
Yes, I do.
How did that come about?
I believe that was Lowenstein's bright idea, to push along the congressional investigation that we were asking for, civilian type, not CID reinvestigating itself. But his feeling was that pressure should be brought to bear from any number of quarters. That was when I finally said this thing was too much and I wasn't going to do any more.
All right. Now here you refer to the April 6th interrogation of you by military personnel. You say, it's really an interrogation, you know. They turn the light up in front of your face and have all these little tricks. Now tell us about this business of staring into the light and the little tricks that were...
Sir, I don't want to make implications that aren't true. I didn't really ever... There was some sort of a desk lamp and someone reached over and adjusted something, and I realized from then on I was annoyed because this thing was shining in my face. That's all. That's all it amounted to.
Where was the light located?
Somewhere on the desk, it seemed to me.
Was it on the far side of the desk?
Sir, it wasn't important to me at the time.
Well, it's become important by the fact that this reference to the light occurs so frequently in these news accounts that I read.
Sir, we're not here to discuss news accounts. I have testified for 3 days. We haven't talked about anything that's factual.
We're here to discuss misconduct on the part of the CID, Warheide said.
Now you say little tricks. What are you referring to?
Oh, the little, what's called the Mutt and Jeff approach that I'm sure you're aware of, where someone badgers you for about an hour or two and then he leaves the room and the other guy sort of puts his arm around you and says, I'm really a nice guy and you can kind of lean on me and we'll get this all squared away. It's a common interrogation technique.
Later, here, you state that the CID man, a technician, I presume, destroyed 50 fingerprints. Now, is that an accurate statement, sir?
That may have been what I said. The numbers are apparently not accurate. There were a lot of fingerprints destroyed. I don't, to this day, know how many.
So when you said 50 fingerprints were destroyed, you now say that this was not accurate?
That was a common statement at the time, sir. That figure was being used a lot. It was just kind of a common thing in talking about it.
All right. Now, do you recall appearing before a body of approximately 100 law students in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, on or about February 11th, 1971?
I remember the appearance. I don't remember the date.
Who arranged that, Dr. McDonald?
Mr. Siegel. He is a professor of law at the University of Pennsylvania, and it was one of his classes. And there was some discussion about the McDonald case at Fort Bragg, and he asked me if I would mind answering some questions from his law students.
Well, I have an article from the Daily Pennsylvanian. I assume that's a newspaper at the University of Pennsylvania. And it says that Captain Jeffrey McDonald charged that both the military investigators and FBI agents falsified and destroyed evidence in an attempt to railroad him into a conviction.
Can you tell us about the FBI, and can you elaborate a little bit on this falsifying and destruction of evidence?
First of all, your propensity to use newspapers as evidence mystifies me. Second of all, I don't actually remember ever saying that.
Well, all right. Moving ahead. Do you remember a letter from Fred Kassab on November 6, 1971, in which he rebuked you because you were in the area and had not called or visited him? And in response you said, I have been in Long Island on several occasions in the last 3 months to continue work on finding 3, possibly 4, more might be added, according to current stories in Hippie Family Number 2 in North Carolina, fugitives.
This is in reference to what we talked about yesterday, McDonald said. This is my trying to keep Freddie at bay. You know, you are taking it out of context. You should have read the whole letter. You probably did, but you don't want the grand jury to hear it.
We'll make it available to the grand jury, Warheide said.
At the start of the fourth day, Warheide again asked MacDonald if he would submit to either the polygraph or sodium amytal examinations. In response, MacDonald read a statement that had been prepared by his attorneys, both Siegel and Michael Malley, a former Princeton roommate who had worked for the defense during the Article 32 hearing and who had remained involved in the intervening years. The first part of the statement maintained that no useful purpose could be served by a polygraph examination because the technique lacked scientific validity and because the results were inadmissible as evidence in a majority of state and federal courts. MacDonald continued to read. Sodium amytal. Mr. Malley has called to my attention as part of his advice that he has known me for 12 years, that we were in the same class at Princeton, that we were roommates prior to my marriage to Colette, and we have talked at length about my feelings, my emotional well-being, and... He paused. He was beginning to weep as he read the prepared material. My ability to cope with the memories in my life after these murders. It was with apparent difficulty that he continued. He believes he knows me as well as he knows anyone, and to the extent it is possible for one man ever to understand another, he believes he understands my feelings towards myself and my life. In his professional opinion, it would be prohibitively dangerous for me to undergo a sodium amytal examination. This is a drug which causes a person to essentially relive the episode. It is not simply recalling, as most of us recall the past, but it is a complete reliving with most or all of the emotional feelings, anguish, fear, and grief, to go with the experience. So overwhelming, apparently, was the intensity of these feelings that MacDonald was once more overcome by emotion simply by reading about them. He sobbed audibly, unable to continue. "Take your time, doctor. Take your time," Warheide said. In a moment he pressed on. After the session, this experience is remembered, and the person has the same reactions as if he had actually relived what was discussed. Once more his sobs prevented him from continuing. "Dr. MacDonald, you are reading that. Would you prefer to have it marked as an exhibit and placed in the grand jury record that way?" MacDonald waged an apparently successful battle to regain a measure of self-control. "I think I'm over that part," he said in a firmer voice. "I'll just finish, if it's okay." "All right." After the session, this experience is remembered, and the person has the same reactions as if he actually relived what was discussed. Because Mr. Malley knows me so well, and knows the murders of my family are the most unspeakably difficult thing I've ever faced, he believes that I cannot recall to this day or describe them without the constant problem of breaking down. I function normally because I try so hard to avoid having to recall, to retell, and to relive. I usually am successful in avoiding to have to confront these memories in direct detail, but this success is a day-to-day battle. Mr. Malley believes, as does Mr. Siegel, that if I were to undergo the sodium amytal session, the reliving the murders would be so emotionally upsetting that I would not thereafter be able to pick up my life. They believe that a drug-induced flashback would be so painful that my normal and largely successful to-date attempts to live with this grief would be destroyed, either permanently or for a long time, so as to make me incapable of living under the circumstances as a normal person in a professional life, as is now possible. Accordingly, they do not feel the extreme and dangerous resort of the sodium amytal is warranted. Both Mr. Malley and Mr. Siegel are friends and lawyers charged with representing my best interests, and they cannot recommend that I undergo it. My advice from them, in the strongest possible terms, is not to undergo such a potentially debilitating experience. "Well, that certainly is your privilege, sir," Warheide said, "and no one will make any inferences on the grounds that you have not agreed to subject yourself to these tests. Now, we had one other request in regard to the notes you kept of your recollections in 1970. Let me give you an answer to that this afternoon, McDonald said. I mentioned it once, and Mr. Siegel spiraled through the roof, stating that was obviously attorney-client stuff. Voorhage moved on to ask McDonald about his association with the Fort Bragg boxing team. Did you work out with them?
Yes, for a short period of time. You've always had an interest in boxing, I take it.
Right. And in college, were you on a boxing team?
It was a very loose club. We had a club at Princeton, and I worked out with them. We never had any matches.
Now, at Fort Bragg, was there any talk between you and the coach about being the team physician?
Right. He said they needed a physician, and I had just come into the gym, and I was watching the boxers work out one day, and we started talking, and he said, "Why don't you work out with us?" And I started working out with them. And then he mentioned the field trips, matches at other posts. They needed a physician. So I thought that was a great idea. So I said, "Well, if it were possible, I would like to do that." And he mentioned specifically there was a long trip to Russia coming up that he would like to have a physician on board for.
When was that trip to be made?
Sometime in the spring.
Do you remember when you talked about this Russian trip?
No, it came up on several occasions.
Well, we're getting into the area very close to February 16, 17. Did you, on that day, meet the coach and discuss this Russian trip?
I don't remember whether I did or not, sir. I've been asked that several times, and in the middle of summer, when my lawyers were questioning me about the events, that was really the first time that it ever clicked that that may have been the day, that there may have been a discussion on that day. But I'm not sure. I honestly don't recall that. Though in his diary for February 16th, 1970, he had written, "Heard from boxing club coach who said I would probably hear within several days about the proposed 30-day trip to Russia. Colette is almost as happy as I am."
During your growing up period, Voorhage asked, did you ever live away from home for any extended period of time?
Yes, I did.
Will you tell us about that?
I went to Texas when I was a sophomore in high school. I lived down in Baytown for, I believe it was Thanksgiving to Easter of that year.
With whom were you living?
Friends of Bob and Marion Stern. I don't know if they were really friends. They were business acquaintances.
And the Sterns were friends of your family?
Right.
What did you say the name of these friends was?
Jack Andrews.
Was he, you might say, a contemporary of the Sterns and your father?
I believe he was a little younger. He was a young engineer for Humble Oil at the time. My father and Bob were older.
Did he have a family?
He sure did.
A wife and kids?
A wife and a boy, Jack.
A boy, Jack. Was he about your age?
Same age. That's why I went down.
What was the reason for your leaving home and living in Texas for this period of time?
Well, we just met them. Jack Andrews was kind of a free-spending type Texan who at least talked big, and he asked me at one time if I would like to come down and meet his son and spend a couple of weeks. So I asked my parents, and they talked it over with Bob and Jack and came back to me and said, if you want to go, fine. And so I left at the end of our football season.
Did you transfer to a school in Texas?
Not initially, because I was just going to stay a couple of weeks. But around Christmas time, they asked me to stay. They thought it would be interesting, and I did too. I was having a blast. So I called home or wrote home, and they said sure. So I entered the Robert E. Lee School in Baytown, Texas.
Were there any family problems which resulted in your living away from your family for this rather extended period of time?
Not that I'm aware of, McDonald said.
Now I take it, Voorhage said, being a doctor, you collected medical supplies.
Sure did.
Did you have any pills, and I have no idea what sort of medication it is, that some people refer to as uppers or downers? I think those are things that have a tendency to stimulate your bodily functions or relax your bodily functions one way or another. There was a bottle of Escitrol diet pills, which had some amphetamines in it. Having seen the CID report, which stated that testing of McDonald's blood did not reveal the presence of any dangerous drugs, Warheide did not pursue that line of questioning, and MacDonald volunteered no further information.
Slowly, Victor Warheide, though still keeping his distance, began to circle closer to the events of February 17, 1970.
"I know you've been asked this question before," he said, "and I believe I can anticipate what your answer is going to be, but I believe the grand jury should have the benefit of hearing it. Did you have any problems of any type, specifically between you and Colette, regarding anything?"
"We didn't have any problems," MacDonald said. "That, as a matter of fact, has been overlooked in the past. There were no quarrels or disputes.
Nothing major."
"Were there any minor quarrels or disputes?"
"Yes, I'm sure there were."
"Do you recall any?"
"No, quite frankly."
"Well, did Colette complain about such things as spending money without you consulting her as to what you were spending money for?"
"Absolutely not."
"I complain to my wife when she does that."
"Absolutely not."
"You bought a stereo down there, didn't you?"
"That's right."
"How much did that cost?"
"I don't know. It was a package deal with the color TV, and it was on time. Like 2 years of payments or something. And the total was $700 or $800 for the two together, stereo and TV."
"Did she get upset about that?"
"No, she liked it. It was the first time we had had nice possessions."
"So, I take it, your testimony is that your marriage was serene, was calm, and there were no problems of any concern?"
"That's right."
"Nothing that troubled the still waters of your marriage?"
"That's right."
"How about the kids? Any problems with the kids?"
"Absolutely not."
"In some of the material I saw, it indicated that Colette was somewhat concerned about bedwetting. Would you consider bedwetting a problem?"
"No, and she didn't consider it a problem either.
The only one that considered that a problem was the CID agent."
"Was this something you discussed with one another?"
"Sure."
"But these discussions didn't result in any arguments or disputes?"
"Absolutely not."
"Or misunderstandings?"
"Absolutely not."
"The problem was that Christy still had a bottle at 2.5 years of age, and I thought Colette should take the bottle away when she goes to sleep. Colette said she didn't mind getting up and getting her a bottle. That doesn't sound like a very big problem."
Neither did it sound like the situation Colette had described to her child psychology class on the last night of her life.
"How about Kimberly? Was she a bedwetter?"
"No."
"She had long since outgrown that?"
"Right."
This, of course, was contrary to what the nurse from San Antonio had said to the CID reinvestigators.
Warheide moved to close range, asking Jeffrey MacDonald to describe the events of February 17th and the days immediately preceding.
"I guess Valentine's Day was Friday," MacDonald said, "and on Saturday, Ron Harrison came over in the afternoon. In fact, Valentine's Day had been Saturday, and Ron Harrison had come over that night."
MacDonald described the discussion of the contents of the Esquire magazine.
"We thumbed through the magazine," he said, "and that was it. That's all there ever was, and for some reason, this has become a tremendously important thing in my life." He continued, "I don't know if Ron ate dinner with us or not. I don't even remember what we did that night. I presume we stayed home because I had to work the next morning."
He described driving to Hamlet, eating a steak for breakfast, and passing a quiet day in the emergency room.
"I had several meals during the day," he said. "I took a nap or two, probably in the morning right after breakfast. I went back to my room and slept for an hour or two, did some reading, and I probably had about 5.5 or 6 hours of sleep Sunday night from roughly midnight on."
During the April 6, 1970 interview, MacDonald had said, "Now, when I'm at work, I hardly ever sleep. I mean, the nurses can tell you that. They just call me and, you know, I'm there like that."
Now, in 1974, he described driving back to Fort Bragg, eating breakfast, and going to work.
"I did office work mainly," he said. "My title was Preventive Medical Officer, which the newspapers took to be, you know, counseling a lot of people on drug abuse, when it was in fact keeping latrines clean. I presume that I was at my office most